Well, good evening, everyone. Let's open up with a word of prayer as we get ready to dig into Providence this evening. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this opportunity that we can study your word and that we can learn and grow from it. We ask that your spirit would be here with us, that your spirit would give us open ears and hearts, that as we look at Proverbs chapter 12, you would give us understanding, and especially, Lord, that you would use your word to guide our feet, to enlighten our path, that we might live well in this world, representing Christ and bringing glory and honor to you. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. This evening, we're going to look at Proverbs chapter 12. And I'm going to read through the chapter here in just a moment. But my plan for this evening is, in looking through this chapter, obviously, again, this is another one of these collections of different sayings, and the topic kind of jumps around a little bit. But there are, I think, at least four general themes you see repeated in this chapter in particular. And so there seems to be a little bit less randomness to a certain extent than some of the others. And so my goal this evening is to try to spend a little bit of time looking at some of the verses from this chapter on each of these things. Again, we won't be able to cover everything. But just be thinking about these four topics as I read through this chapter. The first one is this contrast between the righteous and the wicked. You'll see a lot of this kind of language being used about the wicked are this way, the righteous are this way. The ends of them will look different, actions and things like that. The second category is the category of wisdom. This has to do with knowledge, wisdom, prudence versus foolishness and things like that. I also kind of just threw in some other, there are a couple verses that didn't quite fit any of the categories, but this is a book of wisdom, so I just threw them all into the wisdom category. The third topic is the issue of laziness. This is the smallest topic, but we do have several proverbs having to do with diligence, hard work, versus the one who's slothful or lazy. And then the final topic is the topic of speech. This is something, again, we've seen as an emphasized theme throughout the book of Proverbs. We see that again here in this chapter as well. And of course, there is overlap, because you're going to have some verses that talk about the righteous versus the wicked, particularly in terms of their speech. And so that definitely goes along with multiple of these categories. But I did separate out the speech ones as their own, just because there's so much other stuff dealing with the righteous and the wicked. So those four topics, righteous versus the wicked, wisdom, especially in contrast to foolishness, laziness, and then speech. And we'll be talking about those as we look at this chapter. So let me go ahead and read through chapter 12, and then we'll begin our discussion. Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates reproof is stupid. A good man obtains favor from the Lord, but a man of evil devices he condemns. No one is established by wickedness, but the root of the righteous will never be moved. An excellent wife is the crown of her husband, but she who brings shame is like rottenness in his bones. The thoughts of the righteous are just, the counsels of the wicked are deceitful. The words of the wicked lie in wait for blood, but the mouth of the upright delivers them. The wicked are overthrown and are no more, but the house of the righteous will stand. A man is commended according to his good sense, but one of twisted mind is despised. Better to be lowly and have a servant than to play the great man and lack bread. Whoever is righteous has regard for the life of his beast, but the mercy of the wicked is cruel. Whoever works his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows worthless pursuits lacks sense. Whoever is wicked covets the spoil of evildoers, but the root of the righteous bears fruit. An evil man is ensnared by the transgression of his lips, but the righteous escapes from trouble. From the fruit of his mouth, a man is satisfied with good, and the work of a man's hand comes back to him. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice. The vexation of a fool is known at once, but the prudent ignores an insult. Whoever speaks the truth gives honest evidence, but a false witness utters deceit. There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, for the tongue of the wise brings healing. Truthful lips endure forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. Deceit is in the heart of those who devise evil, but those who plan peace have joy. No ill befalls the righteous, but the wicked are filled with trouble. Lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who act faithfully are his delight. A prudent man conceals knowledge, but the heart of fools proclaims folly. The hand of the diligent will rule, while the slothful will be put to forced labor. Anxiety in a man's heart weighs him down, but a good word makes him glad. One who is righteous is a guide to his neighbor, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. Whoever is slothful will not roast his game, but the diligent man will get precious wealth. In the path of righteousness is life, and in its pathway there is no death. So as we look at this chapter, I want to first begin with this topic of the righteous versus the wicked, the various contrasts that we see here. So what are some things that you notice? You've got, you know, this topic is scattered about. You see it pop up as early as verse 2. You see it popping up as late as really the last verse of the chapter, verse 28, and then sprinkled in between our various verses on this topic. So what are some things that stand out to you in terms of the contrast being presented here in Proverbs 12 between the righteous and the wicked? Let's look at verse 3 for a moment. Verse 3 reads, "No one is established by wickedness, for the root of the righteous will never be moved." What is the idea that the Solomon in Proverbs is trying to get at with this idea? No one is established by wickedness, for the root of the righteous will never be moved.
The righteous man's posterity will benefit mm-hmm. he does, and the other one is just wafting away in the wind.
Yeah, that's a good point. The children of the righteous person prosper from him, but the way of the wicked will pass away at the end. Yeah. When we think about, let me ask the question in this way. You have this idea here of one is established, you know, the root of the righteous will never be moved, while the other does not have that. No one is established by wickedness. And yet we look at the world, and how often is it that it seems that the righteous, the good people are the ones that are going through suffering and trouble, and yet the wicked people are the ones that seem to have prosperity in the world and seem to be in good positions and things like that. Why does Proverbs make this contrast and say that the wicked is not established by their wickedness, but the righteous will never be used? Any thoughts on that?
I guess it's temporal. It is true they prosper, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a grievous thing to, you know, see.
Yeah, it's a temporal thing. Yeah.
And if the roots are held fast, then no matter what comes about at that person, they're not going to change their view.
Yeah.
And righteousness will stay. Where if you're not established, any kind of wind will knock you over.
Yeah, that's a good point. With the righteous, there's a no matter what their situation in this life may be, that can change and, you know, be good one moment, bad the next moment. But there's going to be a foundation, a strength, a steadfastness for the righteous person. You know, they're not going to just fall away from God just because things go bad in a moment. But for a wicked person, you know, you can see them just getting blown all over the place, depending on what's going on in their lives. There's no steadiness or security in that sense.
So where does verse 4 fit into this?
Remind them.
Yeah, so I mentioned at the beginning, for those who got here a little bit after that, I talked about in this chapter of Proverbs, we got like four big categories that I want to look at. One is righteousness versus the wicked. The other is this category of wisdom. Third is the category of laziness, and then fourth is the category of speech. And so just asking the question, well, where did I put verse 4, which is about an excellent wife is the crown of her husband, but she who brings shame is like rottenness in his bones.
Well, even in verse 3, he's talking about wickedness and righteous, and then down in verse 5, it goes right back to the righteous and the wicked in verse 6.
Yes, yeah. Verses 3 and 5, which are on opposite ends of this proverb about the wife and her husband, those are both dealing with wickedness and righteousness. So what in the world is verse 4? And that's one of the difficulties is that, you know, normally when you're reading the scriptures, like context, just that helps you figure out almost anything, what's going on around this particular verse. But sometimes in Proverbs, it's not that easy. Sometimes context clues you in on things, but sometimes it's jumping from topic to topic. And so how does that relate to you? So a couple things to say about verse 4. So one, I placed it under the category of wisdom because, to be honest, I didn't quite know what to do with it in terms of these four categories. But secondly, let's just talk a little bit about the verse itself. Proverbs, obviously, for most of it, is written from the perspective of towards a son. And so a lot of you're gonna find a number of proverbs that talk about wives. You have the Proverbs 31 woman later on. I'm trying to think. I can't think of many proverbs that talk about husbands. Anyone else think of any off the top of their head? They talk about, you know, son related to the parents. I don't think you see many talking about and you see character in general. You can find things that apply to, you know, what does it mean to be a wise man, a godly man, things like that. But not as much as about a husband, which is interesting. But here this is the idea. So for particularly for a son, what is it that you're looking for in a wife? Because obviously, you know, what does our culture look for in a spouse? You look for outward characteristics, you know, oh, I want them to be, you know, to look a certain way, you know, I'm not going to marry anyone that's under, you know, so-called, you know, I want them to have money, I want them to have, you know, this, that, or the other. There's all these things that, I mean, I literally just saw something online an hour ago of this person had like, a, you know, a huge list of this is what I want my husband to be, and, you know, guys have the same things for wives. And Proverbs presents a different perspective of what do you want in a spouse. Because beauty fades. Money doesn't necessarily last forever. There's all these things that we can place stock in that aren't that great. And so what Proverbs presents is you want character in the end. You want someone who knows right and wrong, who is wise. When you look at the Proverbs 31 woman, it's someone who's industrious, who cares about their family, who's hardworking, who's strong, who has sense, who's able to do this, that, and the other thing. The focus isn't on being able to win a beauty contest. And so here in verse 4, you know, what is the excellent wife? The excellent wife is the one who brings honor to her husband, and it's contrast with the one who brings shame. To marry a spouse who is foolish, who does not have sex, who is making the wrong decisions all the time, and especially there kind of seems to be this idea of doing this in public. That's not something you want in a spouse. You don't want a spouse who's going to cause or bring public shame to you. And so here the idea is you need to be careful about this. A wife who brings public shame to her husband is going to be like rottenness. You may get through the honeymoon year when you're both young and Twitter painted and, you know, all that, but over the long run, it's going to be hard. If you place the emphasis on the wrong things, it's going to lead you to heartache at the end. So those are some of my thoughts on verse 4. Jeff, I don't know if you had any other things you wanted to bring up.
No, that's one thing particularly about this section that we're in, where you get this compare and contrast, where you've got the word but is like in every other.
Yes, there's a lot of contrast.
Every verse there. And this goes on until like, chapter 22 at verse 17 and just this whole thing compared. Yeah. So it's almost as if each verse could almost stand alone, and you want to be, we want to be careful with that, that that doesn't, that we take it in context as a whole.
Yes. Yeah, you do have a lot of verses that stand alone, but you do have ones that definitely connect together as well. Mm. And so it's a little hard to figure out which ones do and don't immediately, but yeah, there's definitely a lot of contrast here. What are some other thoughts or questions, particularly on this topic of righteous versus the wicked that we see in this chapter? Let's look briefly at verse 26. Verse 26 says, "One who is righteous is a guide to his neighbor, but the way of the wicked leads them astray." What does that verse mean? I think part of the idea here, especially think about this, one who is righteous is a guide to his neighbor. If you're a guide to somebody, that means there's an aspect of publicness to what you're saying, doing, whatever it is. When you're guiding someone, you have a relationship with them and you're leading them in something. And I think there's this idea that for the righteous person, to borrow the language that Jesus uses, does a Christian shine their light, light their lamp and then place it under a basket? No. We are to be public in our righteousness. We don't just, hide who we are, that, we're Christians when we're at home and when we're at church, and, you just can't tell us it's different from anyone else the rest of the time. No, the righteous person ends up being a light, being a guide to those around them, to their neighbor, the one who sees them and how they live and speak and how they conduct themselves. But what happens to the wicked person? And the wicked person, there's a sense that they're a guide because all action is a public witness and testimony and influence on others. But the way of the wicked leads others astray, leads people down a wrong path. And there's something I saw recently talking about how we shouldn't look to media like TV shows and movies for role models and examples, because they're all just terrible. And it's right, they are. But there's also an aspect where we need role models that we should look to. We need people that we can imitate. I mean, that's an important thing in the scriptures. How is it that you train children? One, by instruction, but two, as example. Think about what Paul says when he says, "Imitate me as I imitate Christ." And so there's this idea that leading by example is actually really important and really powerful. And that's part of what this proverb is getting at. Think about children as they grow up. What is it that children do? They imitate. They imitate everything. If you say something, they're going to try to say it. If you do something, they're going to try to do it. We need to take that seriously as Christians, to recognize that we are a guide to our neighbors around us in the things that we say and do, how we interact with other beings. And wickedness leads people astray. We are always going to be influences on other people. The question is, are we going to be influences for what is right, or are we going to be influences for what is wrong? And as Christians, our responsibility is to be those who are influences for what is right. I think that's what's going on there in verse 26. Okay, let's move on to the second topic. This is the topic of wisdom. And we've already talked about verse 4, which I had under this category, but what are some of the things you might see in this chapter that talk about wisdom? I've got verse 1 under this, verses 8, 9, 15, 16, and verse 25 as well. Any questions, comments, or thoughts on any of those topics? Or you can bring in other stuff as well.
Number 15. Did you say 15?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because I just wish some of our politicians would listen to that one. Because
yep.
It's just, you know, wise men, even though they're wise, they still take advice from people
yes.
that are wiser.
Yes.
Or as wise. They're
yep.
not afraid to take advice. Where someone who thinks that they know everything scoffs off everybody's advice.
Yep, that's exactly right. Verse 15, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice. And this is something we even talked about in our Sunday school a few days ago for the adults when we... when you're looking at James and he's contrasting, you know, the wisdom from above versus the wisdom from below, and one of the characteristics from the wisdom from above is open to reason. Now that's the same idea here, the humility to recognize, I'm not always right. I can be wrong. I have been wrong. And being willing to ask for advice or listen to advice and take it seriously and weigh it. Now not all advice is good advice. And so you have to, you know, have discernment to discern, you know, to know, okay, this is bad, I shouldn't do that, this is good, I should do this. You see it with Solomon's son, Rehoboam, where, you know, his older advisors tell him, you know, be kind to the people, they'll love you forever. His peers say, no, show them that you're a tough guy and, you know, make the burden even worse. And he listens to the wrong advisors and, well, splits the kingdom in two and he loses 10 tribes. He shouldn't have listened to that advice. So the wise man, not only does he listen to advice, he recognizes what's the good advice and what's the bad advice. The foolish man just ignores everybody, does his own thing. That way it leads to destruction.
And just a practical application is sometimes fathers doing things,
mm-hmm.
mechanical things or anything around the house, think because they're older they know
how
to do anything, and they refuse to listen to the advice of the younger who have learned a different way to do something, and maybe easier,
right.
and it causes tension.
Yeah.
And because the older person thinks everybody should always listen to them, as
right.
opposed to listen to, in that case, the wiser person might be younger.
Yeah.
Wise doesn't mean older, necessarily.
Yeah, that's a good example. Wise does not necessarily always mean older. You know, sometimes, sometimes if you've done things a certain way, you can become set in your ways. And, you know, that's natural. There's nothing necessarily wrong with it. But, we still need to have that humility, even if I think this is important too, even if we end up being right in the end, there still needs to be an openness to listen. Because maybe we're wrong. Maybe we're wrong. And we don't, you know, we're finite creatures, we have limitations, we're sinners. Just because someone is younger, just because someone has less experience or, you know, different background doesn't necessarily mean that they're wrong in the end. So we need to be willing to listen, to wait, to see if it actually might be better or not. So.
I also think it shows respect if you, even though you have, like, your own way, but
mm-hmm.
you listen to somebody else.
Yeah.
And just agree that that's a good way. Not that you
yep.
have to do it. But some
yep.
people, like you said, don't even want to listen.
That's right.
Like, my way or...
Yeah. It does demonstrate respect. It demonstrates humility in terms of how you think about yourself, that I could be wrong. And it demonstrates respect towards the other person, that you're willing to listen to what they have to say. Whether they're right or wrong in the end, just listening is an important aspect. Anything else on this topic of wisdom in chapter 12? What about verse 16? The vexation of a fool is known at once, but the prudent ignores an insult. What's that mean?
I guess, does it mean that what encapsulates a fool is generally, you know, anger and conjunction, and so they're triggered easily, they're defensive easily,
mm-hmm.
they're insecure, they're, you know, maybe vengeful, and even though somebody that's prudent they feel those things, they have a common sense to, you know, let it go, or, you know, put it in a river of forethought. So, you know, the answer is more expedient and appropriate than just an outburst.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, the fool, when, you know, he gets insulted easily, and he lets you know right away. You know, you can see and feel, or maybe he is like communicating in anger right away. Yeah, you will.
That kind of reminds me of whenever Robert said, you know, turn the other cheek kind
mm-hmm.
of thing. If you help someone, you know, take your cloak, give them everything else too. Kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yep. So. Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, turning the other cheek, part of that idea is, you know, if someone insults you, don't respond in kind, but, you know, turn the other cheek to them. Often we make it, you know, about a violent thing. It's not just a violence thing. It has to do with insults as well. And, but the, you know, the prudent man is one who isn't going to be perturbed by that kind of stuff. You know, they have a patience. They're willing to let it go. They're not going to fly off the handle when someone says something mean or unkind to them. And that can be really hard.
Self-control.
Yeah, it's great self-control. Yeah. It reminds me of, you know, the other proverb, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. You know, the foolish person is someone who gets vexated and they speak harshly and kind, and what happens? You just have this, you know, building up of conflict and explosion between the two. But that gentle answer, the turning the other cheek, the being kind in the moment to diffuse the situation. Sometimes, you know, someone said something and they didn't mean to insult you. Maybe they misspoke, it was a misunderstanding, you know, you don't have to, you know, let it get to you. You could ignore it, or if it's something you think needs to be addressed, address it with them and get it figured out. But
that's one of the problems with the media now.
Yep.
Because people do react immediately to something that somebody puts out there. And,
yes. Yeah.
We were always taught the 24-hour rule.
Yep.
Think about it for 24 hours before you respond.
That's exactly right. And there's tons of things online, especially, that they present you with something and they say, was this right or wrong? Or, you know, they ask you to make some kind of judgment call. And most of the judgment calls are really bad if you read through them. That's like, that's really stupid, actually. Like, one, you don't know the whole situation. You don't know the whole context. You're just being presented some form of information that may or may not be completely accurate. And then you're told, have this emotional and visceral reaction to it. That's not wise at all. You know, the wise man will ignore an insult. He allows himself to deliberate and take time and figure things out. So we should not respond like that. And that's what the media wants to do, that's what social media wants to do. Those aren't wise, prudent things. As, you know, as we seek to live well, that's not how we should.
Can I add something?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think a fool lacks discernment, too.
Yep.
So even when you're trying to come, or maybe restate what they're trying to say out of vexation, it just makes a lot of sense. And you come back with legitimate points, or, you know, with a soft answer that supposedly turns away wrath, it doesn't always work that way.
Right.
I had a recent experience where that it just, you know, added fuel to the fire.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's where, we'll get to this, you know, sometime in the future when it talks about answer a fool according to his folly and don't answer a fool according to his folly. Because there's only so much that you can do on your own. When you're talking with someone else or relating with someone else, that's a two-way street. You've got two people involved. And there's only so much that you can do. You aren't responsible for the other person's response or their actions. You're responsible for your response and your actions. And as far as it depends upon you, what you're doing to facilitate peace with that. I think it's very important. It says, as far as it depends upon you, live at peace with all men. Because you could be as kind and gracious and merciful and forgiving as anyone ever in the history of the world, but not live at peace with someone because they just refuse to live at peace. That's not on you in the end. And so, I mean, that's the important question. What, before God, What are you doing? What is your responsibility? Are you doing the right thing as far as you're able? And if the other person's not reciprocating, there's not a whole lot you can do about that. You just give it to the Lord and trust that He's going to take care of it somehow. So. All right, let's move on to the third topic. There's only a few verses to talk about this, but there was more than one, so I made it its own topic. This is the issue of laziness versus diligence. And we've got three verses on this topic, verse 11, verse 24, and verse 27. Anyone have any thoughts or questions on these verses on this topic? What does verse 27 mean? Whoever is slothful will not roast his gain, but the diligent man will get precious wealth.
Won't get any gain.
Yeah.
If it's talking in real, if he's out hunting,
yeah,
and he doesn't get there all the right time or whatever, he won't get it.
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, the slothful person, the reason he's not going to roast his gain is because he won't have any gain to roast. Because he was lazy, he didn't get up at, you know, 4 in the morning to get out from his deer stand before the sun came up, you know. Yeah. Some people look at this and say, well, maybe he did get some gain somehow, but even then he's too lazy to cook it or to enjoy it properly.
Yeah.
And maybe he wasted it, or maybe, you know, it could have been something great and he just made it something lesser. But there's this idea, it's lawful, you know, there's consequences for that. It's going to damage you in some way. Or at least, at the very least, in terms of quality of life. Of course, that's contrasted with the diligent man. The diligent man will work hard. And he's going to get wealth from it at the end. Doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be rich. But you're going to be benefited from it. There's always a market for a hard worker. Who's diligent, who's going to do what he's supposed to do. Go the extra mile. I mean, how many stories are there of people who started off at the bottom in a company and rose to the top or very high up because they were the best worker? That's important, as Christians in particular, you know, especially when we think about Colossians, where our work is not done for the respect of men, but to bring honor to Jesus Christ. We're called to be the best worker. It's not a good testimony. There have been too many stories of Christians who, for whatever reason, were not diligent. And it brings shame to Christ. If we want to be wise people, if we want to be Christ-like people, we need to be diligent people, not slothful. Any thoughts or questions on this topic? All right, let's turn to the last topic. Again, this was a pretty big topic. We've talked about this some in Proverbs already. This is the topic of speech. There's a bunch of verses that talk about this. You've got verse 6, verses 13 and 14, 17, 18, and 19, and also verses 22 and 23 talk about this. 22 being probably one of the more famous verses on the topic of speech. So in looking at this, what are some things that jump out to you in terms of how this chapter talks about words and speech and our mouth and things like that?
On verse 13,
mm-hmm.
The evil man is snared by the transgression of his lips.
Yeah.
Righteous escapes. I get it that the evil man is maybe always trying to get out of trouble. And, you know,
yep.
Get himself in more trouble by telling more lies or
yeah.
Cheating more. Or,
yeah, or bragging about his evil deeds. Yeah, you know, for those on Zoom, talking about verse 13, an evil man is ensnared by the transgression of his lips, but the righteous escapes from trouble. The way I got my first job out of high school was a company had to fire a bunch of employees because they were smoking marijuana while on the job. And a bunch of them got caught, but there was one guy that got away with the with cheating the drug test. The problem was he came back to work the next week and bragged about it to somebody, so then he got caught and fired. And I think that's an example. He started bragging about his misdeeds, and all of a sudden he got caught and lost his job, which worked out for me because I got a job and helped pay for college. That was good. But yeah, the lips are powerful things. We just talked about this with Sam Sunday School a couple of weeks ago from James. But here, for an evil person, especially you have that relationship with lies and slander and those kinds of things, but an evil person is going to use their lips for bad things, and it's going to catch up to them at some point. For the righteous person, they use their mouths to do what is right, to promote what is right. And that, if done correctly, it's going to be a blessing to others, and it's going to help you in the day of trouble. Where you're not going to, you don't have to be worried about being caught in a lie because you didn't tell a lie. That's a benefit of doing the right thing. You don't have to be afraid of getting in trouble for doing the wrong thing. So, yeah, any other thoughts, questions, or observations on this topic?
Well, they have a short view. They don't have a contingency plan. They're just kind of hoping other people will do their work and that they can get away with things. They're narcissistic. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it would follow their probably Christian.
Right.
I mean, there are foolish Christians, I know, but if you want to just make it simple, you might understand. Christian versus non-Christian. They don't have the long view. They're not playing the long game.
Right. They're only concerned about the moment, what's immediately in front of them. I think verse 18 is an interesting verse. There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts. The tongue of the wise brings healing. We had a similar verse a few weeks ago, just talking about, I think it was the language of a river of life from the mouth of the righteous person. But that imagery of sword thrusts coming from rash words, like, what is it? Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That's a huge lie. I mean, words can do some of the most damage. I mean, the pen truly is mightier than the sword. And words spoken in haste with a bite to them, it really is like stabbing someone. It really is like slicing a little sword. And when we think about it, I mean, that's strong language. When we think about it in those terms, it should cause us to pause and just think about how important are our words. I mean, here the contrast is you could literally do damage like a sword to someone's body with what you say. Or you could bring healing to them. You could bind them up. You could encourage them. You could build them up. You think of someone who's suffering or struggling or hurting or something, the power of your words to be able to minister to them. Words are powerful. That's part of the idea that Proverbs communicate. Powerful to do damage, also powerful to do good. So we need to take that seriously. But I like the imagery there. It's not nice imagery in one sense, but I like it in the sense that it causes us to think a little bit more about it.
The illustration I used to use for the kids, you take a tube of toothpaste and get the kids to all squeeze out their toothpaste onto it, like they're spilling out words. Just put them on. Now, try to get that toothpaste back into the tube.
Right.
You can't take those words back, and
yep.
Especially talking with or at children.
Yep.
They remember those words forever. So as Christians,
yep.
We have to be very careful not to say something to a child that they'll remember forever as
yep.
a negative.
Yeah. Yeah, when the toothpaste is out of the tube, you can't get it back in. Or it's like, when you fire a gun, you can't take that bullet back. You shoot an arrow, you can't pull that arrow back. It's out there, it's gone, it's It's going to hit what it's going to hit if you're not careful. And I remember one time when I was young, I said something unkind to somebody. My dad corrected me and rebuked me about it. And one of the things he said is that person may never forget what you just said. Mm-hmm. And that really just hit me hard. Of like, just in that moment, I let it fly. And with no thought of the potential long-term damage it could do. Now, as far as I know, it hasn't done that long-term damage, but it was possible. And it's dangerous. Speaking is dangerous. We need to be wise about it. Maybe, you know, we require hunter safety courses for people to use guns to go out and shoot. Maybe we need tongue safety courses before we allow our kids to start talking. Yeah. One last verse, unless someone else brings something up. Verse 22 is very famous. Lying lips are an abomination to the Lord. That word there, abomination, is a very strong word in the Bible. And it tells us something about how seriously God takes the issue of lying. The lips that lie are an abomination to him, something that's detestable, something that he hates. But those who act faithfully are his delight. Those who are honest and true and faithful, he delights in those. He delights in those people. And so that should, as Christians, you know, we should hate the things that God hates and love the things that God loves. And we should desire to be the things that he loves. To be faithful and honest and true and to not be characterized by those things that are abomination to him. So. Any other final comments, questions, observations, anything from this chapter as a whole before we close this evening?
Nope.
All